Hello.
And welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wabo's most dashing work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we are back to get into some more chapters. But before then, remember, we're still in the lead-up to our live stream. The live stream lead-up, Elliot.
Yep, it could go on for another month. It could go for six.
Could go for 10 years. Who knows? But yeah, you know, as we do these episodes, we think it's fun to reveal a new piece of info about the live stream each episode. I thought this would be a fun one to reveal. One of our bonus goals, one of our donation milestones, a pretty easy one. All we have to do is get to $400, and it will unlock a bonus segment during the live stream that I'm very excited for.
That makes one of us.
We're going to pull a Sol and Sol's mum.
yeah, probably.
It's called the Dear Boldest Guest Lecture, and we're gonna get your parents to come in and just answer embarrassing questions about you, I guess, tell embarrassing stories.
I thought it was more gonna be what we're talking about, like trying to figure out if they were good parents or not.
Some of these segments have just kind of wrappers that we've wrapped them in that I've forgotten about, but that's a good one. Yes.
Yeah, it'll be there. I have very mixed feelings about this particular segment.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very fun. So stay tuned for more news on All Packed Up 2, All Powered Up Beyond the Pale, because it's coming soon. Anyway. Probably. Should we get into the chapters? Starting with Dash to Pieces 11.7, we're in Lucy's head, and she is in a training session with Guillemet before he leads her to this kind of gnarled tree monster that needs to be killed.
Yeah, and I wanted to open this with, like, so Lucy was the one who told them, like, oh, we need a day off to, like, recharge ourselves and, like, you know, find our zen again. And she's then elected to go and spend that day training with Guillemet, like... What is she
maybe
thinking?
That is, yeah. No, yeah, you're right. It's she's in work mode. That's what it is. I think she's having some trouble separating her work and her life.
Yeah, it really shows that sort of lack of ability she has with everything going on to, yeah, relax and take that step back. I just think it's funny that she identified that that was what they need, but she's not. She's just not the sort of person to actually be able to do that herself.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
Although that said, like, I mean, we can make fun of her and we can make fun of Guillemet and his really frustrating way of teaching all we want, but we saw how well she was fighting in the last couple of chapters before these ones. Like,
the results are there.
Yeah, like Guillemet, it seems awful the way he's, like, pushing her while she's under pressure and, like, you know, she has all these things where she's like, I'm tired, and he's like, oh, all the better. It's like, you want to call him a dick, but I mean, this shit seems to be working. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it is working. So, thumbs up, Lucy. You're pushing yourself too hard, but it's paying off.
Yeah, maybe not so much in today's lesson, but we'll get there. But, like, it definitely reminded me, like, back when I used to swim a lot in high school, that was, like, our swimming coach's thing was, like, she'd absolutely slam us so that, you know, you're, like, crazy tired and stuff, and then you do the drills focusing on, like, form and stuff, because the idea was meant to be, if you're able to teach yourself to do it right when, like, you're absolutely wrecked, you're going to be able to do that more easily, like, when it matters, like, in a race or something.
Yeah.
So, like, I see Guillemet's logic. It's just, I mean, it's that fairy drama stuff, right? Like, he's just such a dick about it. It's so fun for us.
Yeah, it is fun. I liked this beat of Guillemet threatening to cut off Lucy's ponytail, because it's like, you know, the stereotype of people being entitled to other people's bodies, or specifically, I guess, people like touching black women's hair as like this prime example of a real easy marker to tell if someone's just very self-absorbed and doesn't really think about other people at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen it in this story specifically with Lucy. Like, her hair has been a big thing.
Yes.
It's come up with the Mr. Bader, that dickhead gym teacher, and then it was used to make us hate Ray for a while. Like, even if you're not generally aware of those sorts of stereotypes or whatever, like, you know that this is a thing for Lucy.
Yeah. I just think it's a great, like, symbol of Guillaume's slip that Lucy kind of picks up on and talks about, right? Like, it's he is quite literally becoming more self-absorbed and doing a very classic, like, non-empathetic, self-absorbed kind of person thing to do. It's just very, like, slimy, I don't know.
Yeah, well, because, it's missing, like, kind of ironically for him, a bit of that understanding of nuance as to why that's not okay.
Yeah, exactly.
As you said, Rook talks to them about this later on and really frames it around this idea that, like, as he's falling to winter, he's becoming less flexible. And I really liked that because it finally made, like, remember when the fortune teller in Arc 8 was all like, oh, you won't like what he becomes? And that, I've never understood what that actually meant, but now I'm like, I feel like I'm getting an understanding for it now. It's like he'll become more rigid, and that just means he's not, I mean, especially as a mentor, like he seems to be slipping more into this mentor role, but it's like, he's not going to be a good one.
Yeah, not a good mentor, exactly.
So he's going to keep trying to mentor people, but he's not going to be as good at it, and it's going to be harder for them, is what it sort of feels like. And I mean, like, we see him fail in this lesson here today. Like, Lucy eventually gets the lesson he's trying to teach, but he says by that point it's too late, and then Gashwat ends up saving the day. It's interesting. It's like, as he falls to winter, he's also just becoming worse at his job.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he's not, there's a conversation about, like, him discarding parts of himself, but, like, there's no world in which a one-track mind Guillaume can ever be, even at that one thing, good. Like, being good and kind requires a kind of holistic understanding that Guillaume's just not going to have.
Yeah, and when it comes to mentoring, like, you need, like, when you're teaching someone or mentoring someone, you're teaching them, like you know, you need to adapt stuff to the student, as, like, you know, you don't just sit up in front of a classroom and lecture people, unless you got big classes or you're a bad teacher. But like, I'm just comparing this in my head to, like, you know, if he was just a master swordsman, like he's used that as an example, where it's like, you know, if a master swordsman falls to winter, they're still going to be probably a very proficient swordsman until they encounter a very new situation. Whereas I feel like with mentoring, part of why Guillaume has gotten so much out of it is probably because it is so varied. But then as he goes into winter, he's going to suffer for it even more because he won't be able to keep up with that variation.
Yeah. I don't know. I just think you're right that mentoring is something where you need to be especially responsive to the mentee, I guess. But, like, regardless of what it is, there's no, regardless of what the thing that a winter fae kind of focuses on, they're inherently just going to be shitter at it because they don't have holistic knowledge and reaction times.
Yeah. I just feel he's going to get it harder than, like,
oh yeah,
like most fairy. I wonder if that's going to be important. Maybe it was just because I had a bunch of conversations about this, like, coincidentally throughout the week, but I couldn't help but tie this to, like, the whole idea that as you grow older, like, as a human, you, like, lose some of that neuroplasticity and can't, like, adapt as well. Like, you know, the standard example is the way old people can't get newfangled technology, sort of stuff. Like, it started to make me think of this whole falling to winter thing as a bit of an analogy for how, like, you know, fairy are all about, like, finding new experiences and telling their stories and keeping themselves engaged. But even they eventually seem to succumb to that part of aging, which is just where the world starts to leave you behind. And so now I'm starting to wonder, yeah, like is that going to be part of Guillaume's sort of fall to winter? Like, yeah, will it interact with things like Grumble in the story? Like, I haven't put it together, but yeah,
I like the idea of there being a parallel with Grumble as well. I wonder if that will play into it.
Yeah, I don't know what that looks like yet, but it feels like it just feels like that sort of thing is happening to Guillaume. Like, he just is gonna fall behind. And like, it makes me think, like, oh, because obviously, like, we know he mentors Marisica, like, a little bit at least, in between them being enemies. And so, like, it just, it feels like it leads credence to me to this idea that maybe she's trying to do something to help him, or I don't know.
Mm.
Still desperately clinging on to the hope that he's actually a goodie and not involved in this, but you never know.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. We'll see, I suppose. So, yeah, Lucy figures out what Guillermet is trying to tell her and looks up and sees this monster in the trees. Gashua jumps out and takes the initiative.
His entrance is so good. Like, just as we've got this, like, highfalutin fairy who's, like, very complicated lesson plan is just sort of starting to fall apart. And he's thinking maybe he can get it back on board. Gashua just fucking tears in and stabs it in the face while screaming, like, expletives. It's so great.
Mm, it is good. I want to pull out this line that made me laugh, where, you know, Guillermet's talking about humans as compared to fae and goblins and stuff, and Guillermet mentions that humans are, you know, they don't live very long, but they are able to tell interesting stories while they're alive. And Lucy's response is, oh, like a limited run of a television series. And Guillermet's like, no, that's not. And he kind of gets a bit offended. He thinks that that's very blunt. But, I mean, that's a good analogy. And I think the thing that I love about fae is anytime anybody makes an analogy about fae or what a fae is trying to say, that's even like the slightest bit reductionist, as any analogy is, right? Because that's basically what an analogy is a reduction. The fae always get upset because I guess they don't like their thoughts or their personalities being reduced down in any sense of the word. But I just find it very hilarious how much they usually hate analogies.
Yeah, well, I feel like they just hate the idea that their ideas could be reduced or made out to not be overly convoluted.
Yeah, could be understood easily. Oh, no, that's not right. There's more depth to it that you don't understand, actually.
It has to be complicated.
Yeah.
I really like this because obviously, like, what happens in this chapter is yeah, like Guillermet is sort of trying to set up all these convoluted puzzle pieces like this and explain this grand lesson, and then the way Gashua just comes in and like quite literally cuts a Gordian knot is just very fun and sort of sets Lucy on the path to, I think, like, the real lesson she's starting to take away from all this, which is what she talks about, where, like, goblins lose the forest for the trees, whereas fairy lose the trees for the forest. Like, this is a thread that goes right back to, like, arc two, where she sort of sits in this middle ground where sometimes she leans into fairy instincts and sometimes she leans into goblin stuff. And as we start to meet Rook, you can kind of see how the real lesson she's taking from Guillermet and seeing the goblins is that, like, she can forge her own path in the middle.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a classic balancing act for Lucy. It's don't be too fae, don't be too goblin.
Like, you have the ability to take the strengths of both and try and leave the weaknesses of both, and like I like that that's what she's seemingly trying to do. Like, lean into whichever one is more appropriate. Like, because that's what Guillermet talks so much about, how you got to trust your instincts and adapt and do the, like, ask the right questions at the right time. And the right question at this time was apparently, can I just go and stab this thing in its face? And the answer was
yes. Do you think Guillermet is trying to, in his own way, get that point across? This was a thought that I saw in comments and stuff of, like, you know, Guillermet talking about there being an opening coming up and stuff like that, that, like, kind of does make sense if he knows that Gash is about to attack.
I've seen people talk about that. That's not my read. I think Guillermet was just caught off guard here, and isn't keeping up. Like, I mean, you know, it's fairy. There's always the possibility that this is all some 8D chess move by him. But I think he just straight up failed.
Yeah. Fair enough. Fair enough.
I mean, wait, what's your read on it?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of the same as you. I could see it, but it probably feels a bit too layered for a Guillermet that is clearly kind of starting to falter. If it was Guillermet Prime, I'd be more willing to believe it.
Yeah, unless he wants us to think he's faltering, but, like, that's that level I refuse to engage on. I also just wanted to, like, so there's this moment where, as Gashward's about to kill it, Lucy's all like, wait, give us a sec, and she sort of turns to the thing and it's like, hey, like, are you gonna be cool? And then it keeps getting aggro. So she's like, oh, whatever, and just lets Gashwood kill it. And I just kind of wanted to call that out because I feel like having been in Avery and Verona's heads a lot more for the most recent chapters, we see like they very much go out of their way not to, like, you know, want to kill even like a wraith that's trying to kill them. Like they're,
yeah.
And they're always like, oh God, it sucks when they sort of have to kill something like this. Whereas Lucy definitely seems much more like, you know, when something's like, I'm not going to be cool, she's like, oh, well, fuck it, it's your fault then. And like, she can go to sleep that night knowing she did give you a chance, but you didn't take it. I guess as we go into this plan against Marisica, it's interesting to know. I feel like she is the one of the three of them who's the most like, she sleeps the easiest at night if she has to kill someone who wasn't being cooperative.
Yeah, it's interesting that she's willing to, you know, dole out justice like this, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, she thinks about it a lot more in the conversation with Rook, but definitely, like, in a combat situation, she's the one who's sort of the least forgiving.
Mm.
And that's why she's the one who's just going to call in all the fucking witch hunters in her letter. Like,
yeah.
At the end of the day, what matters the most to her, I think, is...
is that justice is served.
Yeah. And that she doesn't lose. I mean, that's another thread that comes up a lot in this chapter. Like, she... mm. She doesn't want to lose. I don't read that as in a selfish, sore losery way, but more just like she's seen so much shit in the world, she just can't stand to think that the baddies are winning anymore. So it's like, you know, yeah, she'd rather burn the whole town down than let the baddies win.
Mm, yeah.
And so this whole like lesson that Guillaume's teaching her here, it feels like it's got to be a metaphor for the town, right? Like. Because something we haven't really touched on is, like, there's this whole sequence where Lucy's, like, running around and there's sort of this mixture of she has to figure out the grander puzzle while Guillaume is, like, you know, trying to touch her hair. And so she's mm-hmm. running around and she's got to keep a lookout for him but also try to put the larger piece of the puzzle together and figure out why this is happening. And I just couldn't help but be like, is this a metaphor for, the whole story? Like, we keep getting... I think the exact phrasing Lucy uses is like, he set himself up as a nemesis, but that's a distraction. And I was thinking, is that like meant to be a takeaway for like Marisica and Edith? Mm. Like they've set themselves up as the nemesises. But is that just the distraction? Do we need to dedicate more time to trying to figure out what the fuck they're trying to actually do and like tackle that rather than them?
Mm. Interesting. What's the snarling tree monster though, you know?
I mean, it feels like it has to be something related to like what the furs are doing to the town, right? Because that's so similar. Like, it feels like it's becoming knotted in some way, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's like, because I feel like I have no idea what's going on. And the only way I feel like we can start to figure that out is to find the nemesises like Marisica and figure out what their motivations are. Like, so I don't know how to, yeah, I don't know.
Mm.
I just feel like this will be a thing. This feels like one of those ones where we're going to look back on it and go, oh, yeah, Guillaume was showing us a clue towards X.
Mm. Mm.
It's just a cool inversion of the whodunit if
yeah.
The answer of whodunit isn't really the point.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah, I wonder. I wonder if there's something that's going to be inherently, if that does happen, that would be unsatisfying, that there's no, like, you know, Scooby-Doo mask off moment. I don't know, though. Maybe not. We'll see, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm, yeah, I'm trying to think. Yeah, yeah. Could be.
I mean, I still think they'll be behind it. Like, it's like, you know, Guillaume yeah. is the reason Lucy's there. So, like,
yeah.
The culprits are still the culprits. It's just... are we losing sight of the actual problem because we're focusing on the culprits? It feels like the question that this is raising to.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, interesting. I guess we'll have to wait and see. That's a definite wait and see. There's no answer that we can have to that, right?
No, I'm not clever enough to come up with it if it is there, yeah.
So, yeah, Lucy heads to meet the other Kenneteers, stopping for a quick chat with Wallace on the way. And this is very nice. You know, talking about relationships, we've kind of mainly focused on this for first Avery and now Verona, but like the more normalcy that the Kenneteers can get in their lives, the better.
Yeah.
Self is obviously a very important concept in the other verse, but like, yeah, as we've kind of touched on already, Lucy feels like she's she's losing her work-life balance. She kind of feels like the 13-year-old version of like a grizzled police detective who's has no life outside of the job, right? So the more of a life she can have, the better, I think.
Yeah. There's so much I want to talk about here. I mean, you're right. Like, she just needs more moments like this. Like, what I love about this is just how, for the first time in a long time, she just felt like a 13-year-old girl. Like,
yeah.
Before this, she was fighting a fucking part divine, part spirit, part elemental monster in a forest that was trying to vacuum suck her into the sky and eat her.
Mm.
And at most, she felt like a little stressed. She was more annoyed that somebody was threatening to touch her hair. Whereas here, she's like, her narration just gets so much more stressed. She's second guessing everything. She's like it almost feels like you're starting to read an Avery chapter. Like, she's overanalyzing everything that's said, everything she says. Like, it's just this honestly throws her for a loop so much more than any monster fighting, and it's just hilarious and like realistic, and it's just good to see.
Yeah, definitely. It's delightful.
I mean, that said, it's still very Lucy. Like, she's fucking brave here. Like, the part where Wallace kind of accidentally gives the impression he's not keen when she first asks him, and she just really sticks to her guns, and he's like, yes, I'm asking you for a date. We could talk about this or this or this. And like, I probably, like, if this had been me, I would have just folded the second he was like, are you asking me out on a date?
Yeah.
I would have been,
your heart drops when you read that, doesn't it?
So yeah, like, good on, especially because I imagine Wallace is just an idiot and had no idea that he was implying that he wasn't keen. He probably would have been kicking himself. So it's good for both of them that she didn't let up, but it's just, yeah, good on you, Lucy.
Yeah. Good work, Lucy. You got there.
And then, yeah, this whole part afterwards where she's like catching up with the other Kenneteers and they like just talk about it is just fun. Like, I continue to be amazed at how in like these Wabo stories, some of the most fun and exciting bits to read is just when the characters are all just having a normal conversation.
Mm. Yeah. There's a moment later. I mean, you're right. Those are always the best bits. And I think there are a few really juicy ones in these chapters. I love just some of the like hanging out and chit chatting bits that happen with Avery and her family. Like, there's all kinds of great ones.
And like, I feel like that's just the, like, such a good marker of how good the writing is in these stories and the characterization that, like, even more than the giant vacuum spirit monster fight, I was enjoying just watching like Avery and Lucy tear into Verona for what she was up to with Jeremy, and then Avery like living vicariously through Lucy and her normal relationship. Like, it's just watching the three of them bounce off each other is way too enjoyable.
Yeah, it's good. So yeah, the Kenneteers regroup. They meet up with Reggie, who takes them to talk to Rook, who is acting like a jerk to maintain her cover.
I love how Lucy has that moment of, oh wait, we're meant to be acting, like, because she's just been like unashamedly pro Rook. But I guess her cover there is she always was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You mentioned Reggie as well. Like, I hope we get to see a lot more of Reggie, because like, there's a moment where Rook offers Reggie food, and that got me thinking, like, hey, what is Reggie's relationship with food? Like, it's got to be a complicated one, right?
Yeah, true. That's a definitely a complicated relationship with food he would have.
Like, yeah, I almost imagine Rook has to remind Reggie to eat, otherwise he probably just doesn't.
Yeah, I wonder. Maybe all the various eating disorders and stuff all kind of like cancel each other out. Does that make sense?
I mean, I guess if there's like an even mix of like overeaters and undereaters.
It's horrible.
Like, I mean, it seems optimistic.
Oh, what a stupid joke. So anyway, going back to Rook. Yeah. Like, I really am digging Rook's vibe.
Yeah.
But having said that, it feels too good to be true that there's a group of Ken and others that are unequivocally on their side. And so I'm kind of like, I'm glad that Verona is like doing some clarifying questions, verification questions, like, oh, is this tea drugged? which is a very suspicious question, but I love it, Verona. And Rook's answers all seem good. I mean, she seems to be loyal to, like, the vision of Kennet, Missa's kind of vision, which is good. That's what we want. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just, it just feels like it's too good to be. Remember that chapter where Miss came back and also it was revealed that Rook was actually an ally?
Yeah.
Ever since then, it's just felt too good to be true.
I mean, Rook does have that moment where she basically says her focus is on what happens if they fail. Like, she's not, she's like, oh yeah, I'm like, I'll help you and stuff. But it feels like the majority of her focus is you're probably not going to succeed. And I'm trying to make sure that Miss and I can do something after that.
Mm.
Which is like, makes it feel a bit more believable to me that it's like, she will help them a bit, but like, she's not all in on helping the Kenneteers. Her primary focus is assuming they're going to fail, which is something that really upsets Avery. So I'm willing to continue buying it for now.
Mm. Okay, fair enough.
Also, just because I just love her, like, professionalism, I suppose would be the word I use here. Like, as you said, like, they pretty much sit down and Verona's almost immediately like, is this tea drugged? Are you even who you say you are? Are you even on our side? And Avery starts to get worried they're going to offend her, but Rook is very much just like, nah, these make sense as questions. Like, yeah. And then she just sort of asks them back. She's just like, yeah, well, so I mean, to be fair, though, like, I don't know. It just, like, compare it to, like, how Edith and Marisica used to respond to questions, like, back in arcs 1 and 2. Like, they, you know, Edith would get emotional and Marisica would dodge the question, whereas Rook's just, like, immediately, like, even answering their questions better than they were asked, like, should be like, oh, you know, no, I'm not doing that, and also I'm not doing this. Like, she's just so upfront, but also clever about it. It's great.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's nice that Rook is letting them be practitioners even when they're asking her potentially awkward questions.
Yeah, yeah, she's got that respect for the fact that this stuff is necessary. Like, yes. It's like, you know, she's been in a war and has seen this sort of stuff happen, and she knows she doesn't take this stuff personally. She knows that it's actually just the clever thing to do.
Mm.
I really respect that.
Mm.
I find her, like, the more we see of her, though, the more, I don't know, confused I am a bit by her whole vibe. Like, she's obviously this, you know, like, other revolutionary who fought in a war to sort of fight against practitioners and all that stuff. But, like, she's this weird mix of old-fashioned, though, on top of that. Like, she insists on breaking bread in this way. Like, you know, we all have to be seated before we can start eating. She yells at Verona a bit later on for pointing at her, which I at least attribute as this very, like, old-fashioned-y sort of opinion that pointing is rude. Maybe less old-fashioned, just very formal. Like, I'm interested in this weird dichotomy she seems to have within herself of being both a revolutionary, but then also someone who sticks to the rules and formalities.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's good. It's nice. I mean, Lucy kind of calls out the vibe of Rook is feels like you're talking to a fae but more direct, which Lucy appreciates, and I just think that's very apt. Like, she obeys these formalities but also will just, like, be like, yeah, this is the world we live in, there's formalities, but here, let's do things, you know.
Yeah, or she sticks with them when they matter, but she will ditch them when they're not appropriate, I guess, would maybe be my read. Like, which fits into that, all that stuff we're talking about with Lucy and, like, you know, the idea that, like, the fairy stuff is important and you got to think like that, but also sometimes just stab someone in the face.
Mm.
But it feels like Rook would be that person. Like, Rook will, you know, break bread with you one night, but then if you are a problem, the next night she'll just come and stab you in the face.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like that.
She's got a good vibe, doesn't she?
Yeah. And like, again, just like with the whole concept of Oni, she drops all these extra little details about, like, her and her compatriots. And it's just, I always want to know more. Like, she talks about here again, I think we've heard this before, but this idea that Oni isn't like a category, it's like a uniform. So, you know, she's not like a fairy or a goblin where she belongs to this category of other, but, like, she specifically makes it clear she's different. She's wearing a uniform. And it's like, what does that mean? Like, is there a mechanical difference to that? Like, the fact that only a uniform and not a category, what does that mean practically? Why does that distinction matter?
Yeah, I get the sense that it's kind of like a being an Oni, defining yourself as an Oni helps the Oni shit that you do land, because that's the category that the universe kind of accepts for you. But yeah, I don't know. That's just is so wild of a thing to exist in this world that it's hard to really conceptualize what that actually means.
Yeah, it's just a difference that keeps being singled out as a distinction, and I just wonder why. Is it just a semantics thing? Does it just matter to the Oni because they don't want to be categorized in that same way? They want it to be clear that it's like, this is not what you have all decided I am, this is what I have decided I am. But anyway, is there another difference to that?
Yeah, I don't know. So yeah, Rook and the Kentiers are planning on how they might take down Marisica, and Vrona decides they're going to need some outside help.
Yeah, and something we haven't talked about for this like whole conversation, Rook is just fucking making eyes at Lucy. Like, Lucy's just constantly noting that like Rook is just staring at her the whole time. Which I'm optimistically taking to mean that like the vibing that's going on between Lucy and Rook is like going both ways.
Yeah, they're mutually respecting each other, hopefully.
Yeah, because like remember right from the get-go when we read the email about Rook, I think Lucy was like, I like her. And I just like to think that from the second Rook saw how Lucy operated, she was probably like, yeah, I like her. As we've talked about, like Rook is defining her own uniform and a role as an Oni, and that feels like what Lucy's trying to find with this middle ground she sits in between fairy and goblin, and I can't wait to see her. I can't wait to see the two of them go forward in those directions. Like, I feel like there's so much for Lucy to play off of on Rook. I almost started like familiar shipping them before feeling that probably won't go anywhere.
Yeah, that's almost certainly not going to happen, but I like the vibe. Rook also mentions that she's very convinced Marcy is a conspirator. So that's as close to confirmed as we've got so far. But, you know, I'm still expecting a big twist coming.
I mean, it's as close to confirmed as the Kentiers have got. I mean, we saw in Edith's interlude. Like, we know.
Well, yes, true.
But for the Kentiers, this sort of, they've had these kind of suspicions, and there's like the coin thing, which is like evidence, but not really. It feels like Rook being like, yeah, I agree, is sort of like for them, okay, so it's almost certainly a thing.
I
agree with what you said a second ago though. Like, I agree there has to be another twist coming.
It feels like there's more twists coming in this story, and who knows what they are.
Yeah, I'm mostly hoping that that's true, just because I am still desperately clinging on to this hope that both Charles and Guillaume are innocent. But for that to be true, there has to be something else somewhere, because like with all the information we've got right now, they can't both be innocent, it feels like. And I'm just desperately hoping that there's something else that will make it so that can be true.
So here's a quote that I liked from this conversation. Rook asks them, are you prepared to lose? And Avery's response is, are you prepared for us to win? And I think that's just a great question, like challenging. Because as you mentioned, Rook is kind of planning for, okay, when they failed, how much time have they bought us to survive or whatever, you know. I like that Avery asked, are you prepared for us to win? I'm sad there's no response to that from Rook, because I think it's a great question to get rid of any potential, doubts about Rook's allegiances. But I just thought it was a great move by Avery, a very, very strong, compelling argument.
Yeah, like, is that sort of the thing, Rook? Maybe she isn't paying enough attention to the Kentiers. I don't know. I agree. It is a good question. I will say in general, though, like you brought up that Rook avoids answering this question. She does deserve props, though, for a number of times she brings the Kentiers back to their original topic. Like, we've seen it time and time again. These three do have a bit of a habit of, like, as they're bouncing ideas around, you know, they drift way away from like the original thing they were talking about, and they don't always come back and address the original question. and the amount of times Brooke will just, you know, suddenly be like, but yes, to go back to what you asked me before about Marisica, I think, like, blah, blah, blah. I was just so grateful because every time they'd ask her a question and then move on to another topic before she'd finished answering, I was like, just screaming at them, like going like, no, let her finish. I was so glad she was there to be like, I am going to finish this thought, and like always bringing them back to earth and making sure the plan was always moving forward rather than going sideways.
Yeah. She's helping them stay on track.
Which especially they need for this Marisica one, because this is, one of the trickier problems they've faced. So,
yeah.
So yeah, I guess the last thing we should talk about really in this chapter is Rook does drop on us the tinfoil bait that every new other, apart from Pekkasnot and Tashlit, was recruited with some play in mind by
some manipulation or trick or trap.
Yeah. It's basically an invitation to try and go through the whole list of new Canada others and try and figure out what is Marisica's secret plan.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we've done that a bit. I mean, do you have any... Should we just go through them, I guess?
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't think we've done a very good job, to be honest. I'm just gonna put that out right away. Chloe and Nibble as the first two, I just feel like we've probably already seen it with, like, the fact that a rabid Chloe was set on Lucy, which, you know, really scarred her and made her ditch Avery for, like, a week. Like, I feel like that's probably the sort of stuff that Marisica was thinking to use them for.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure what else it would be other than the exact thing we saw play out. You know, like, the fact that, to be more specific, the fact that they know that there's a kind of a loophole in the Awakening Oaths where Chloe or Nibble going, you know, acting on instinct to attack the Kenneteers is kind of allowed. I think that's it for them.
Yeah. And also, like, because there are others that you can do that with. Like, I feel like with them, the other thing was we saw Edith feeding them the rotten body. Like, is that something, like, or actually that just feels like a tool to get to what you're talking about with, like, where they're rabid. If they're not getting the healing that they think.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on Ken? Ken's the one that really stumped me.
Yeah. I, my gut thought was by bringing in Ken, maybe as a way to, like, make the problems with Kennet more overt to the Kenneteers so that they're more likely to want to leave, like Verona with her mum, Avery going away with whichever parent is moving away, I can't remember, and potentially helping Lucy be okay with that or want to move as well. Like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, or the other thing is, if Ken can somehow be used to turn the town against the Kenneteers, like, we've seen him used to move people in the right spot, move the Kenneteers more easily. And a lot of that is riding on their reputation as the town's practitioners. It's like, if that gets hurt and Ken decides he doesn't like them anymore, he might turn all that stuff against them. Like, if they're building a reliance, we see actually Verona use city magic to travel again here. They've got the furs locked in that half street, which they're using city magic to access. Like, is it just the fact that they're building a reliance on having access to city magic as the practitioners of the town, maybe?
Yeah. Ken's the one that Ken definitely, to me, is the one that's the hardest to understand. So we've got Rook. I mean, is the Rook one just that she's anti-practitioner, so Marisica possibly thought that there would be more to exploit there?
Yeah, that's the impression Rook has. So unless she's got a blind spot for herself, I think we're just meant to write that off as her having already kind of served it, is what she says.
Jabba, do you have thoughts around Jabba?
Not at all. Like, I mean, he's... because I don't see what he can do to the Kenneteers, apart from maybe target their families.
Yeah, Jabba to me is maybe useful to, like, to manipulate the innocents in town or something. Like, the ability to abuse the innocence and get away with it. I don't know.
But that was like, that was explicitly why he was brought into town. So it's like, how does...
Well, yeah, true.
How do we, sneaky. Yeah, how do we go from that to some master stroke that Marisica can pull out at the time it matters to hurt the Kenneteers? Like, it has to be their families, right? That's all I can think of.
Maybe, yeah.
What about Monty? We got old Monty here.
Well, again, yeah, Monty's one is very similar to what I think of Jabba's, which is like the reason that we already kind of know about, right? Monty can, take over, I guess, the barrier and potentially fuck with Miss. But we already kind of know about that, so I don't know if there's something else.
Yeah, like, maybe... the other thing I always come back to with Monty is this thing where he just, beyond his control, will, like, completely subsume a system. Like, they, in part, ration him on the barrier because they don't want him to get his claws too deep in.
Mm.
So is that something, like, is there something Marisica will stick him on that he will completely take over? Like, is it the barrier? Is it something else, like the furs? I don't fucking know. Yeah, is there something she can stick Monty on and have him completely take over that takes it away from the Kenneteers permanently?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe Monty can, you know, we know the barrier can potentially mess with practitionering, so maybe Monty augments that, makes that more viable. I don't know.
Yeah, we've seen him overtake, like, the network of bells that Raf set up. I think, have we seen him take over, like, rune systems?
Mm.
Like, I feel like he's more the sort of thing you could drop on something the Kenneteers have set up to take it away from them, like exactly how he was used against Raf.
Yeah, could be.
Because he's like a great counter, because it's kind of the more intricate and, like, powerful a network of things is to stop stuff, the better Monty actually is at kind of dismantling it and taking it over.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, that's where he feels very valuable.
Yeah, I like that. Sig to me feels like a fairly straightforward one, in that Sig is another that can easily kind of become a pawn to Edith.
Yeah, same with Liz, really. Like, Liz and Sig both sit in this, like, spot in my mind of, like, they're great for gathering information and they were Edith's pawns. Like, I don't know what else. end of sentence. Maybe to serve as a distraction here, because I think part of the convoluted plan we're going to discuss in more detail next chapter is the Kenneteers are going to go talk to them. Like, is that just it? They're meant to serve as a distraction for as culprits when the time is right.
Oh, but so of all of the ones we just ran through, Ken and Jabba feel like we really don't understand them.
Yeah. Yeah, they're the two that I just sort of look at and I'm like, I don't see it.
Yeah. Well, something to keep our eyes on, I suppose.
If only it was time to run a new discussion question.
Yeah, we can save that for next week.
Yeah, if it's still relevant next week, I feel like, yeah, absolutely. Don't feel like you have to wait. If people have ideas,
sure. You can,
yeah, throw them at us.
Totally. Yeah. But yeah, let's move on to 11.8, shall we? We're in Avery's head. Avery has headed home, and we see some of the family departing as a trial for this Kelly family separation, in air quotes.
Yeah, this chapter, like 11.8, is essentially the chapter of, again and again, it finally hits Avery how bad things are going to be for her as her family splits apart. I think she finds herself longing for the days when this house was full of all the idiots, as opposed to all the idiots were scattered and even more difficult to deal with.
It's interesting. It's going to be interesting. We will see. Before we get into that, though, before she gets home, Snowdrop turns into a plush Snowdrop. And I mean, like, first it was Snowdrop shirts, and now this. Snowdrop is the most merch-forward character that has ever existed in a WAPO story. I'm very excited to see WAPO announce the Snowdrop merch store soon.
I mean, I would absolutely buy an official Snowdrop plushie. I mean, you could probably just buy, like, an Opossum plushie, right? Like, that'll do in the meantime. But I agree. I just, every time something else with Snowdrop comes up, I'm like, oh, come on. Like, Wobba has to be getting ready to drop this store on us any day now.
Yeah. I mean, he must, it must be coming, right? Like, it must be.
Yeah. Shop till you drop.com. It's got to be a thing.
So something else, she goes in and she's about to interact with Sheridan, and Avery in her head thinks, goblin number one. Is Avery thinking of her siblings as goblins? I mean, I think it's a great way to describe them. It leans very well into this, like, goblins are toddlers comparison that we've talked about before. I just think it's funny that it's so overt in text now.
Yeah, I feel like her family was a big part of that link being made at the start, because Kerry and Declan sort of lent right into it. But also, we really shouldn't undersell how well, like, Rowan and Sheridan do also live up to it in this chapter. Like, Rowan's, what, 18? Sheridan's 16? And they have a huge fucking fight about who called shotgun and whether dibs applies. Like, it's just... the example they're setting for the rest of the family is just hilariously terrible.
Yeah.
That said, though, like, before Rowan shows up, like, Sheridan... is just, again, she's doing that unique brand of, like, antagonistic love that she has, that I just enjoy so much, because that's how I've been for most of my life. Yeah, very fun.
Yeah, it's, I do like, especially Sheridan, like, the relationship between Avery and Sheridan continues to be great. There's this moment where Sheridan is the only person that doesn't hand wave away whenever he mentions some othery stuff. Every other character has just kind of ignored it, but Sheridan's like, oh, tell me more, and Avery says, you're supposed to go, haha, silly Avery, or something. I just thought that was very funny, but to maybe bring down the mood, potentially this implies that Sheridan, because of her own kind of isolation in the town, is like close to becoming aware or something, so the universe doesn't like hand wave it away for her as much.
I mean, you're right, she's definitely a candidate, but she's getting out of Kennet, which is a good first step.
Yes, definitely it is.
You're right, I just very much enjoyed, like, Avery, like, because this is like Verona's bread and butter, is like this sort of practitioner version of sarcasm where you just overly explain the truth and kind of brush it off. And Avery, just the first time she's really trying it, Sheridan's just like, ooh, tell me more. And it's like, no, wait, what? Shit. I hope for Sheridan's sake she's not becoming aware, because it sounds like she's finally on a good path. Like, getting out of this town was kind of, she was using that as an excuse, at least, for not having her shit together, was that she hated Kennet. So it'll be interesting to see if she actually can do something as she gets out. And as you said, like, she actually shows interest in Avery here, and she dresses it up behind this whole thing of like, oh, you know, I'm just checking in on you so that if you get into a really bad spot again, I can act superior because I asked. And it's like, yeah, whatever, Sheridan, you just actually care. Like, sell it to yourself however you want.
Avery gets roped into babysitting, and she basically just stirs up shit for Declan as she hangs out on a Zoom with Liberty.
Good. Should we talk about this whole family situation, actually? Like, just, I really am trying to give Kelsey and Connor this benefit of a doubt when it comes to this whole thing, because I do think it's unfair to ask either of them to, like, give up their careers if that's what they're passionate about and they're both doing well. But, like... This family was already a clusterfuck before this, and now they're making it worse. And Kelsey's whole vibe as she's trying to rope Avery into the babysitting thing here is like, hey, things are getting crazier and we really need you to step up. And it's like, do you not remember what happened to Avery a couple of months ago? Like, this is such a bad plan.
I don't know. It's hard to know. Like, the reason that they give is because Avery's dad is kind of caught late at work with something, right? And theoretically it would have all been fine, but her dad's got stuck at late at work. I don't know. It kind of implies, like, to me, they've got their hearts in the right place and they were kind of planning around stuff, but their plans are unrealistic.
Exactly. And it's just, this is the sort of thing where it just, like, maybe if things were okay like when they were getting into it, that you could sort of be like, oh, it's going to be rough, but we can get through it. But it's like, it just feels ridiculous for them to pretend like they were coping before they decided to put the family on hard mode like this.
Mm.
I mean, maybe we're being unfair because it seems to be working out for like Laurie and, for Rowan and Sheridan. But like for Avery in particular, she's getting fucking left behind again.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I don't know. I think we will maybe see it come to a head again. Like, it seems not, like we said, it seems unrealistic. It seems like a good intentioned idea, but not something that can actually really function well in reality.
Yeah, I'm going to be interested to see if Avery is able to step up and tell them that.
Mm.
'Cause she hasn't in the past.
Mm. Yeah. So yeah, Liberty demands a steep price for this conversation, which is that she asks to see something uniquely gross. I think that's very hilarious. Avery's really not prepared for this request, and her response is like, Declan's attitude to women is gross, which is true, but it's like clearly not the kind of thing that Liberty was after. It's just, yeah, again, like a very fun premise for an interaction, a very fun little interaction that makes a Wabo story so much fun.
Yeah, you're right, because they're so clearly on different wavelengths. Like as you said, Avery's 100% right that, like, Declan is very gross, but, like Liberty sums it up perfectly when she's like, this is just sad gross, not, like, fun gross. Like, you know, I wanted to give you a kind of fun challenge, and this is just really sad. That said, what are the things that comes out of this? Like, so Declan's playing this game that's, like, about mental health and clearly not getting it at all. But the thing that really jumped out to me is that part where he's like, oh, I've managed to convince Amber to be secret friends so that the other kids won't make fun of me.
Mm.
Somebody needs to have a fucking chat with Amber, because, like, what is she doing? She's so much better than that.
Yeah, she's really limiting herself.
Yeah, and wait, we need to have the intervention with Amber and talk to her, because, like, yeah, somehow Declan's figured out how to not actually step up but get the reward, and Amber's the one who needs to, like, not put up with his shit.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
But yeah, to touch on Liberty, like, I love that moment you point out, like, the part where she's like, oh, what? She's like, I have to extract a price from you to do this favor, and, like, I fully fell for it. I was getting ready for, like, legit conditions and stuff, but it's like, no, of course, she's a goblin practitioner. Her like, conditions are like, just, I don't know, this really hilariously, like, simple and disgusting test of, like, compatibility. Like, prove that you're willing to work on my level and that, like, you know, we're actually going to be a good fit by doing something gross. It's such a great moment.
Yeah, no, it is good, isn't it? Yeah, can we also talk about the moment where Liberty talks about wanting to date Avery's hypothetical brother? kind of weird. Kind of a weird moment.
She talks about wanting to date a not so hypothetical brother for a bit before Avery finally gives a massive list of reasons why that's a bad idea. I mean, Liberty says it's just because she's never dated a redhead, but, like, it feels like a compliment, right?
Yeah, like, I think so. It's a strange one.
Yeah, but I don't know. It's like, hey, you're cool. Do you have any siblings? Like, I feel like there's a compliment mixed in there, just in a very goblin-y presentation of, can I date your sibling? I don't know. Overall, Liberty just, like, it took me back. Remember how much we were fucking on board with Liberty after her interlude? Anyway, I just remember wanting Liberty to be the next Kenneteer, and I was right back on that train seeing her in this video call, like, there's so many little details in here that just made me, like, think she's such a cool person. Like, she, the second she appears on the video, like, screen, Snowdrop's still doing this weird interpretive dance with, like, windmill arms, and Liberty just instinctively, like, does the same thing, and then as she sits down.
Yeah.
And then, like, when Avery's like, oh, we want to go after this fairy, Liberty's like, okay, but you're going to have to tell me, like, what the fairy did. Like, she's not just instinctively like, yeah,
let's, yeah, go, she's fuck not shit just up. Willing to fuck shit up, which is so good.
Yeah, like, there's just, we're constantly getting details from Liberty that's just like, Liberty's fucking cool.
Mm. Yeah, she's great. Yeah, I'm excited to for her to come back into the story. I think it's exciting.
Yeah, so am I. Like, her as the goblin mum and her and Zoid was so great. I can't wait.
Yes.
I can't wait to see how she bounces off, like, the Kennet goblins more. Like, yeah, yeah, it's going to be great.
Yeah. So, yeah, Liberty's on board. So we jump back in time to the planning session, and the Kenneteers are kind of hammering out the details of this plan.
Yeah, and Rook has a very interesting role in this one as well, where she's like almost not the idea comer upper, but like the one who provides context or shits on ideas. It feels very coachy the way she doesn't want to, she doesn't seem to suggest things. She lets them suggest them and then gives them feedback.
Mm.
Like, much better teacher than Guillaume, is all I'm saying.
Mm. Yeah. So in this conversation, actually, I think Verona's really on the money. Like, Verona comes up with some very, very fun ideas. She comes up with the Liberty idea. Oh, is that right? Sorry, I'm remembering the previous chapter now. But yeah, Verona's just kind of like throwing out ideas about how they can get to Marissica. She talks about the idea of the goblin kangaroo court, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah. Although, like, I think, like, the conversations of her ideas sort of lead to this, all these discussions about, like, how do we do these ideas but well?
Mm.
Like, because what a lot of Verona's ideas are is it's like they're going to be effective, but they're pretty full on.
Mm.
Like the idea of just drowning Marissica in goblins like that is, I was like, okay, like, this is sort of going to work or whatever, but it's also, like, a shitty thing to do. Like, again, we're sort of in that realm. Like, this is the same sort of questions that were coming up with the Edith stuff, where, like, we know Marissica's guilty. So in this particular case, like, I'm personally kind of fine with, like, Marissica eating a bit of shit because we know she deserves it. But they're not 100% sure. And it's like the idea of drowning Marissica in goblins to, like, question her or to, like, let the goblins into their cave to, like, steal their shit and do, like, a search warrant.
Mm.
It's like if they had a claustrophobe and they stuck them in a tiny room to interrogate them. Like, it's a shitty way of, like, putting them in a bad place to be able to more easily manipulate them into giving answers. And it's like, I don't know. In this case, I can get behind it, but it's that same debate we're entering of, like, in the more general case when you're not sure. And when it's not, like, a fairy, if it's someone else, like, where are we drawing the lines? Where, what's okay?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, maybe you're right. I don't know. It is this conversation, and it's, again, similar to what we were talking about with Edith, of, like, we know they're right. So it takes some of the teeth out of some of these metaphorical discussions when we know with certainty that Marissica is guilty.
Yeah, like, Marissica's the perfect thing to sort of explore after Edith, because what we started to talk about with Edith was that idea, like, I think it was in the latter half of her thing, where it was like she was abusing the system a little bit because she'd made that promise, and so it was like she literally can't answer their questions unless they sort of bind her and kill her, and so it became like, how do we work with someone who is using the system to sort of fuck with us. And Marissica is like the epitome of that. Like, she will, if they do everything by the book and, like, easily and like normally, they're never going to get her because she's smarter than that. So it's like, yeah, how do you do it when it's somebody who can play the system like a fiddle?
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I don't think there is an answer. I think we know that Marissica is guilty, so we can accept them going outside the specific letter of the law, you know? But
yeah, and that is sort of
again, there's no universal cases or rules that will apply.
Yeah, like, exactly. That's so much of what Pale has been talking about. Like, there isn't going to be a system that works in every case. So I guess it's just, how can the Kenneteers do this in a way that they and everyone else feels like they did it as properly as possible? Mm. I feel like that's what they're trying to figure out with all this shit. Like, okay, we know we can use goblins. How do we do it in a way that we can all feel good about?
Yeah. So, yeah, I think as our conversation is kind of proving, the other thing that comes across from this section of the text is how much messier and how, you know, much less clean the takedown of Marcy is going to be. Like, they don't have any actual evidence that will let them indict Mariska, and so they kind of have to be a lot more sneaky and tricky against a Faye, which is, yeah, I don't know, just kind of wild.
Yeah, like that. I had the same thought. Like, as this plan kept evolving, there kept being more and more parts. And I think even at one point, Lucy's like, wow, this plan has a lot of pieces. And all I'm thinking as I'm reading that is, like, isn't that a bad thing? Like, if you're going up against a fairy, I feel like the last thing you want is a convoluted, you know, mini-step plan, because that's their fucking bread and butter. But the whole point of introducing the goblins is to go against that exact concept.
I don't know. It's just interesting. I'm very excited to see this showdown.
This is going to be the Edith stuff, I think, went so cleanly in the end. They sort of had her locked up very quickly, and then the messiness was like dealing with the aftermath. It just doesn't feel like that's going to be the case with Mariska. This is going to get messy before they have her in metaphorical chains.
They realize they don't really have anything they can do until they can kind of bait and trap Mariska. So in order to gather some evidence, Avery has an idea. Let's bring back Kel.
My jaw dropped when I read that. I was like, oh wow,
we're getting wild,
playing with fire.
Yeah.
But yeah, this whole idea of, hey, here's a story that we think she wanted to tell but didn't get to. Can we bait her by playing into her hands? And I was like, oh, okay, this is a bold strategy.
I think it's going to be a bit of a mess, but I'm excited to see that mess play out.
Yeah, as readers, we sometimes have that same fairy instinct of just wanting to see the story play out, and that's what this is playing into.
Mm.
I'm like, oh, this is going to be a mess. I can't wait as a reader.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, the other thing they talk about doing as well is they're like, oh, maybe she'll do something when we talk to Sig and Liz. So we're going to go talk to Sig and Liz. And I support that because I want to see them have those, for want of a better word, conversations.
Yeah, I totally want to see the interactions with Sig and Liz post Edith's takedown.
Yeah, but I just can't, like, they talk about this as like, oh, maybe Mariska will do something while we're doing that. Now it's just like, I don't know, it seems weird that your plan is, hey, she's expecting us to do X, so let's do X and see what she does. I feel like the answer is nothing. She's expecting it. Like, what are you talking about? But I'm supporting it just because I want to see what an interrogation of Sig looks like.
Yeah, true. what does it look like? God knows.
And again, so they're also going to apparently rope in some other practitioners. Like, they're going to talk to Toadswallow about getting permission for Nicolette to spy. And
yes. God, how fun.
There's going to be another 1 to 2 chapters of setting this plan up that's going to be wild.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. God, yeah. I'm so keen on it. So, yeah, we're kind of starting to set up what's going to happen. Then we jump back into the present. The Kentiers continue to set up shrines. They're still paying off that debt, I suppose. and Avery continues to bolster her self-esteem with these glamour check marks. And there's no way that's ever going to turn out badly. That's definitely not foreshadowing.
I mean, like, I don't know. I feel like that could be the... Because the glamour check marks, that's Guillaume's seed that he planted. And Kel is the seed that Mariska planted. So it feels like we're about to watch those go head to head. Like, so some of this is almost going to come down to where's Guillaume stand, because I'm willing to trust his bullshit with the check marks is going to counteract some of Mariska. It feels like this is actually going to be not Avery leaning into Mariska's story to have it, but Mariska and Guillaume's stories with Avery's glamour fucking playing off each other and coming to a head in a combat thing there with those two glamours. I don't know.
Interesting.
My thing with the glamour check marks was not to think about how they'll interact with Marisica, but think those came from Guillaume, and we've seen fucking Marisica and Guillaume indirectly fighting with each other before. I think it's going to be both of their plans for Avery coming to a head together.
Mm, yeah, that's very interesting. I hope that's what happens. It's a kind of glamour showdown with Avery as the proxy between the two of them. I think that would be delightful to see play out.
Yeah, especially with Guillaume being this thing. Like, I know in the fandom, you know, there's debates about, oh, is Guillaume a villain or not? You know, I don't think anyone could really be fully sure. Like, we'll have opinions, but so it's like you've got the Guillaume's like allegiances thing sitting in one side, and then you've also got like we get a hard confirmation here that he will be falling to Winter at the end of this summer, which, like, you know, of course he is, because that's when all these deadlines are coming together. But, like, it, you know, that with all of his stuff wrapping up here, it's just it's going to be fun to start to get an idea of what is actually going to happen with him.
Also, God knows.
that realization that he will be falling from summer at the end of summer, I somehow had not put that together until this chapter. I was like, fucking hell, of course.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of it either until it was mentioned in the Discord. Yeah, it's good stuff. I mean, with these ominous fae glamour kind of, you know, notes, this is where this chapter ends, and that's where our discussion on these chapters shall to end. There's no extra material this week.
Wait, so hold on, I do have one more thing.
Oh, yeah?
I just realized I sort of did skip over something I wanted to talk about, which was, you know, I guess as we're ending the chapter, like, I feel like the theme of this chapter was Avery coming to terms with her new home situation, how shit it is. And she has that moment with these shrines here, where Lucy does an okay job of trying to help her with it. But Avery sort of ends it on this note of, I guess I can put up with my home situation for the next 2 weeks, but I'm going to have to reevaluate at the end of that.
Mm.
And I guess, yeah, I'm very interested to see where that goes, because that feels like a very sensible position to take for me. Like, these 2 weeks are going to be a lot, and she does need to be here, but it seems ridiculous to think that at the end of that, she shouldn't take a step back and say, okay, if things are better now, what should I do? And wait, she has to leave, right?
Mm. I mean, yeah, I don't know. Who knows what's going to happen with these Kenneteers? Avery and Verona both feel like they aren't going to stick around Kennet forever.
Yeah. I mean, with Avery, it's almost easier for her to leave, because she can come back, like, she will actually be able, like, she could organize something where she comes back to Kennet for weekends or something, you know, like, or every second weekend, like, and that way she's still meeting the oath, and it kind of suits her whole vibe of arrivals and departures that she's living in two different houses at different times. So I just can't see it where she commits to living in Kennet full time at the end of the story, whereas Verona, like, it's a bit more all or nothing with her. Like, she, if she's going to go live with her mum, it's just going to be whenever she can convince her mum to come let her visit Lucy and stay at Lucy's that she'd come back. I doubt she's volunteering to go stay at her dad's.
No.
Unless he gets custody, I suppose. Maybe she doesn't get to volunteer.
Yeah, God, I hope that's not where we're going.
In weekends with the dad.
I don't know. Like, yeah, the Kenneteers and their relation to Kennet is going to be very interesting after the main, you know, conflict of the story wrap up. The resolution of the conflicts of the story, I suppose we'll have to see. I think there's no way that they're all going to stick in Kennet, right? It doesn't, even if they might want to, it doesn't seem like the right move for at least Verona and Avery, not permanently.
No, exactly.
Mm. But anyway, that's the end of our discussion on these chapters. Before we finish up the show, time to dive into some Pale predictions, Elliot. Predictions that our community has left in our Pale Predictor form, which is linked in the show notes down below. I've put out a prediction from Edan Dor, a new predictor that we haven't put out a prediction from before. So welcome to the show, Edan Dor. Basically, their prediction was they think Miss is innocent, and that's not a big prediction, but the reason that it's important is they think that Miss and Rook, there's something going on there. And if they think Miss is innocent, then they think Rook is going to be guilty. And that's the real meat of this prediction, is Rook's guilt, which I pulled out specifically because it was something that I was kind of vibing from these chapters anyway, or not vibing fully, but just kind of like suspicious of. There's a lot to this. There's a lot of parts in this prediction, but I just think as the Kenneteers, and what it Endor says is, as the Kenneteers place trust in Rook, especially Lucy, it's gonna make this betrayal all the more juicy. Which I think yeah. will be fun if it happens.
It would. There was a bunch of talk about whether I think it was Crooked Rook is like bound to the seal and can lie. I don't know. It'd be interesting. I'm just so on board. I guess my list of people who I can't bear to think would be guilty is growing to include Rook.
You've got Rook on that list already?
Yeah.
I don't know. A Rook betrayal wouldn't be the same level to me as like a John betrayal, for example.
I trust Lucy's instincts.
Okay, fair enough.
I don't know. Yeah, I've got Rook on that list. I've already fallen in love with her. So put her next to Guillaume and Charles.
Fair enough.
Although I'm willing to believe Charles was involved, but I just don't believe it was his idea.
Yes.
And they talk about that actually briefly earlier on. They want to bring the Alabaster in for Charles to get some mercy for him, which is nice.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be nice.
So I cheated this week, and I did not pull out a prediction from the sheet. Instead, I just wanted to shout out Snowdrop's Tiny Fans fucking document they've published, which is like, if you're in like the subreddits and discords, you may have already seen it, but it's this basically ridiculously exhaustive summation of every piece of evidence we have relating to the conspiracy. I'm going to link to it in the show notes, but it's like, it's 47 pages long at time of recording, and that's not including the following 70 pages of sources. This thing is so comprehensive.
Yeah, it's really above and beyond.
Just outrageously thorough. Snowdrop's Tiny Fan deserves, everyone needs to go take a look at this. They deserve all the attention for this. It's funny how reading it, I was like, oh, surely after putting this together, you can figure it out. And the answer is no. like reading through it myself, I was like, just going in circles because, you know, there's for every single canet other, there's a thing on why they may or may not be a culprit. And as great as this document is, it also serves to prove how great Wabo is at setting up this mystery.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of threads and leads to follow.
Yeah. So I definitely go check this thing out. If you're ever thinking about theorizing on who done it, use this document to just double check every piece of evidence you should possibly need to consider.
Before you have any theories, this is a perfect place to start.
To just sort of fact check it against everything you should know.
Thank you, Eden Dor, for your prediction, and thanks Snowdrop's Tiny Fan for just putting together this absolutely amazing document. Just a reminder, I suppose we're still running a discussion question. We're talking about, will Toad Swallow be a good leader? Who would you have put in charge? You can leave your answers to that in the discussion thread, which we've linked in the show notes below. But yeah, that's our episode. Thanks for joining us, folks.
Yeah, we've already got a handful of great answers to that question.
Yeah.
But you still got another week to get them in.
Yep.
So you can chuck that answer, or answering like theory, like chuck some theories in on the new Canada Others.
Yeah, what the twist is for each new Canada Other, I guess, or the trap.
Yeah, I'm actually just looking, and there's some stuff on that in Snowdrop Tiny Fans thing as well. So you got a resource there to double check everything relating to those theories as well.
You can follow us on Twitter if you would like to. You can look up, what is it? It's Pale Reflect Cast. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
I wanted to do Pale Reflections Cast, but there's this like character limit. Twitter has this whole thing with not letting you have characters, and I'm not a fan of it.
Yeah, how dare they? But anyway, yeah, follow us on Twitter, and you can get notifications about stuff that's going on. Or just head to the source, go to doofmedia.com and check out all the great things on the Doof Media Network.
Yep, there's a calendar there which tells you, you know, when everything's coming out. Like, you know, about this time next week, it'll be the Game Club. So come listen to us and Alexandra talk about Disco Elysium.
Yeah, that'll be a fun one. A lot of stuff to talk about for that one, I think.
Yeah, it is a game I very much love, but also want to throw in the bin.
Interesting.
I feel like I'm going to be very positive about this game, but they've got also sometimes it drives me up the fucking wall.
Yeah. Totally. But yeah, that's coming next week. So check out the website if you want for more info on that. If you want to support the Doof Media Network, you can go to patreon.com/doofmedia. Becoming a patron is what helps us do our shows, keep them going, but also just all the other stuff that we do. Things like, you know, Game Club or Book Club, which I think came out today, or all kinds of other things that we do. The reason that we're able to do so much is because we get love and joy and support from all of you patrons. So thanks. And if you want to be one of those lovely patrons, go to patreon.com/doofmedia.
Yep. And don't forget, Wildbo is a patron supported author. patreon.com/Wildbo is the place to go if you read Pale and think, hey, I'd like more of that.
And that's that. See you next time, folks.